This episode of Where Did the Road Go is brought to you in part by our Patreons. In particular, the episodes in November are partially sponsored by a generous donation from Christopher Sheehan. If you want to become a patron, go to wheredidtheroadgo.com. And now our show.
Transmission start. Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Join us as we wander off the path and explore lost history, consciousness, the paranormal, unexplained mysteries, alternative thought, and much more. We are present on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now here is your host, Soraya.
Welcome to this edition of Where Did the Road Go? Tonight my guest is Walter Bosley, and we're going to be talking about his book series, The Empire of the Wheel. This is a two-part interview. You'll get the next part in a week. Unless you're a Patreon, in which case you get the whole interview right away. And I've added a couple levels to the Patreon thing, if you're interested. I mean, there's a $3 level that's been there the whole time. You still get all the same stuff at the $3 level, but you got a $10 level and a $50 level, which enable you a couple other things. So go check it out if you want to help support the show. And really, really appreciate it. You can also help us out just by spreading the word. Leaving us some good reviews on iTunes always helps. Everything helps. And I thank you guys. You are the most amazing listening audience ever. You really are. All right. Without any further... Oh, we also have a new t-shirt design. So you can go check that out in the store at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Jeff Ritzman made this sort of ghost ship design that's pretty cool. So go check that out. And yeah, let's get right into this talk with Walter Bosley. All right, Walter, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on. It's good to be here.
And I've been wanting to have you on for a while. I always listen to your interviews on everyone else's shows. And you have quite a number of books out at this point. And yes. we're gonna talk a little bit about that. But first, why don't you give people a little bit of your bio, your history, where you were in national security for a while.
Yes, I was for actually 19 and a half years. Wow. Technically, when you count the year and a half I did background investigations for people who need security clearances. And of course, you know, what's interesting about that number, the 19 and a half, 19.5, that gets into all that tetrahedral mathematics that Richard Hoagland talks about. So how's that for some weirdness, right? I have a career that's 19 and a half years long, but mostly 18 years between the FBI, the Air Force, and then doing counterterrorism work as a contract guy. And it was a lot of fun, a lot of interesting stories to tell. Started out as a young guy and got out of it still relatively young, and, you know, decided to pursue other things.
So being involved in all that stuff, is everything you say disinformation?
All of it, every word of it. You cannot believe a thing I say or write. I, you know, because I was one of those evil special agents of the Air Force OSI, and we know how, you know, rotten and devious those guys are, right? That's what I hear from always a certain, you know, certain number of folks out there. They look at me and they go, I don't know about you, but I win them over eventually.
Well, your stuff does not in any way, shape, or form come across like disinformation. That's the thing.
Well, thank you.
You know, it's not, you're not out here talking about how, you know, UFOs are what's DeLong's term? Secret machines.
Secret machines. Oh gosh, Tom DeLong. Yeah. Yeah. I try to tell people that, you know, Air Force OSI is actually a fine organization, and when you look closely at the things that people think that they have done in the UFO world, it's not so much as they thought it was, and it wasn't exactly as they thought it was. And particularly with the not that this is what we're going to be talking about tonight, but particularly with the legendary, infamous Benowitz affair. You know, when you look closely at that, anyone who looks closely at that will find that it was not the Air Force OSI that did the real nefarious things there that, in my opinion, you know, when I've looked at it deeply, I've come away and I see the hands of the NSA in the bad stuff there. And anyone who looks at it closely, you know, would fairly, being honest with themselves, would see that too. So for what that's worth.
All right. And after that, you're currently what, a private investigator?
I am a licensed private investigator in the state of California. And I'll say it again, for what that's worth, the PI industry, I'm one of those classic independent guys. Okay. I'm the guy who has the shingle on the wall and, you know, I pretty much work out of my home and I'll do I'm a surveillance expert, a physical surveillance expert, have been since the FBI taught me how to follow people. You know, I could follow my own mom, you know, all day and she'd never know I was there, that kind of thing. And however, these days, the PI industry, particularly in California, is mostly done by the corporate folks. A lot of the corporations, the insurance companies, figured out a long time ago that having their own investigators was something they liked better than, you know, than hiring out and stuff. So it's I write the books to fill the gaps. And the income.
And you write both fiction and nonfiction.
Yes, I do. I write pulp fiction, you know, pulp horror. It's got some humor in it. My most recent one was actually kind of a men's action adventure homage to those 70s books by guys like Alistair MacLean. You know, yeah.
And the fiction came first.
Technically, yes. I was a fiction writer in writing screenplays long before I ever attempted to write nonfiction. I have a love for the creative writing, and I do have some non-pulp stuff that I'm revising and going to be getting out there again because I'm proud of it. It's good stuff. And you know, but I caught the nonfiction bug, and it's hard to stop.
Because it seems like you're what you've uncovered here just keeps getting deeper and deeper as you go through your work. What made you start writing nonfiction?
I had a very strange, curious experience at Disneyland back in 1981. When I was in high school, with an interesting character, an old man with white hair wearing a black suit, called himself Alfred, and it stayed with me for you know, several years. Never forgot that. And in Manhattan, when I was working for the FBI, one day at lunch, I went to a bookstore I used to love to go to all the time, the Coliseum bookstore down by Columbus Circle. I'm not even sure it's still there. And I'd, of course, go through the paranormal books, and I came across a book, The Old Straight Track, written and published in 1928. You know, and I'm looking at this book, and it's about telluric currents, you know, or excuse me, ley lines. Right. It's about ley lines, you know, and wow, isn't that interesting? Written by a guy named Alfred Watkins. And I open the book and there's a picture of Alfred, and I got goosebumps because I was looking at a photograph of the man I met at Disneyland in 1981, also named Alfred. And it was him. And so that was kind of weird. And that added another log to the weird fire on that Disneyland experience. So after several years, you know, I was telling our mutual friend Greg Bishop about it and started looking at some other things about Disneyland, and it just kept getting weirder. And I decided, you know what, I think I need to put this all together and present it in a book, not just my experience, but some of the other weird things about Disneyland. And essentially what I discovered is that, in, you know, this is my theory, this is my opinion, speculation I put in the book, is that Disneyland was engineered to be a psychotronic device. There are, according to my guy who did the geomorphology of the park, there are three what are popularly called ley lines, but are more technically telluric currents. That's the extreme low frequency energy of the world grid that runs through the planet. You think Nikola Tesla, you get the idea of the world grid. Well, there is the grid of the major lines that run, you know, horizontal and vertically, but there is the offshoot energy. These are curvy linear lines. Okay, and three of these, according to my geomorphology guy, Sesheri, three of these intersect on the Disneyland property, the original Anaheim Disneyland. And the carousel used to sit right on top of that intersection. So I decided, you know what, I really need to put this in a book. And that's what Latitude 33 is all about.
Okay. All right. Now, so do you think that the Alfred you met was a ghost?
Ooh, there are, and of course, obviously the book goes into this, but there are three or four possibilities. My personal favorite, of course, is that it was the real Alfred Watkins transported across time and space to Disneyland, you know, what, 45 years after he actually died or whatever. Into the future, that would be great. I would love for that to be. Another possibility is that it was merely just, you know, how the universe and the trickster play the little games with you, you know, with perception. It might have simply been a man named Alfred who looked like Watkins, okay, who was put in my path because I was riding the carousel when I saw him. Now, remember what I said about the carousel being on the telluric currents. At that time, the carousel was still sitting on that intersection. After 1982, when they redesigned Fantasyland, the carousel was moved. In my opinion, Disneyland as a device was disengaged in 1982. It doesn't work anymore that way. But it was working the night I was on that carousel, a Wednesday night in the 9 o'clock hour. Some people will recognize that little strange tidbit and phenomena, the whole Wednesday night at 9 p.m. thing. And there I saw this man who was essentially a double for the Alfred Watkins. So it could have been, you know, the universal trickster throwing this lookalike named Alfred in my path while I'm on that carousel so that it would stick in my mind, so that I would recognize there's something to this when I saw the book in Manhattan, so that I would then down the road write the book. That's one big, giant, complicated possibility. The other possibility I already told you is that it was the real Alfred transported across time and space. Another possibility is a tulpa, and that's one that Greg Bishop suggested to me. A tulpa of Alfred Watkins himself generated by, you know, the carousel generating this energy, the lay slash telluric current connection to Alfred Watkins' work, and on and so forth. So any number of possibilities, each one, you know, strange and fantastic in its own way. Whatever the truth is, it was weird enough to get me to dig in and find these things.
Have you always had an acceptance of strange things like this?
Yes. Particularly since I was 16, I had a weird kind of personal awakening event at 16. And after that, I really noticed, you know, weird stuff, little weird things that would go on in my life, be it synchronicities, you know, number stuff, presences. So yeah, it, and before that, it's not that I wasn't interested or completely ignorant of things. So yeah, you know, the kind of stuff, basically the weirdness of the world, intrigued me. I just didn't know nearly as much about it as I did starting that day, you know, when I was 16 and woke up in the weirdness, aware of the weirdness, I should say.
Okay. So you started with that book, and that led you into your first Empire of the Wheel book.
Yes. You know, I was talking about that curvy linear telluric energy of the world grid and how three of those curvy linear lines intersect in Disneyland, and the carousel you used to sit on top of it. Well, after finishing that book, to me, the next logical curiosity was, well, what if I follow each one of these lines? Let's start in their northern direction, because the way they intersect, they run north-south generally, basically. What if I just pick, you know, one or two of the lines, all three of them, and just follow them to see where else they go through Southern California, and if it corresponds to any other weirdness. Mm-hmm. And what I found was that two of them come out past, you know, through the Inland Empire, which is where I live. And I thought, oh, wow, that might explain why San Bernardino Valley is so darn weird to begin with. But little did I know. And so I thought, well, let's start with ghost stories or other paranormal events. And I looked up, you know, ghost stories in San Bernardino, and what I discovered was a posting by a librarian named Ann Walker, who was talking about the ghost of a woman named Cora Stanton, who, you know, from her research, was haunting a store at the Inland Center Mall. And, you know, a mall that been around since I was a little kid. It opened in 67. I remembered going to it, you know, pretty much all my life. It's still there today. So I met with Ann Walker, and she filled me in on the Cora Stanton mystery, a woman who allegedly was a suicide, but there was some strange, funny business about the whole everything surrounding her death. And she urged me to go to the special collections room of the library here in town and see for myself, to look at the newspaper reports, and because she was convinced the woman was murdered. Hmm. So I did just that. I went and looked at the newspaper reports, and not only did I find, you know, what Ann said, that it appeared that there was murder here in this case, that the woman had not committed suicide. I also did kind of a more expansive look. You know, what else was happening around this time of this mysterious Cora Stanton woman's death? And I found six other highly questionable deaths happening in the second half of 1915 is when this happened. The first one in August of 1915, the next one in mid-October, and then the deaths started happening just within days of each other. There were two children and this Cora Stanton woman who died. The day her body was found, one of the two children died. And then I think the next day, or maybe it was the day before, been a while since I, you know, looked at so closely at that material. You know, the other child died. And then a couple weeks later, a 14-year-old girl, and then just days after her, the final victim. And what was curious about all this is that, of course, you have this mystery woman, Cora Stanton, who allegedly poisoned and then drowned herself. And there's all sorts of weirdness about her death. Hmm. But you have the two small children, a brother and sister. We're talking, I believe, 2 and 4 years old. They were given poison candy. And the 14-year-old girl, who died a couple weeks after Cora Stanton, she was given a poisoned orange. Nobody knows who gave these children this candy or this orange. The toxin itself, they never were able to identify it. And in those days, they knew their poisons. The laboratories, 1915, were better than people might imagine. And they could have identified just about any poison out there, and they were never able to identify the toxin in either the candy that killed the small children or the orange, which suggests that we might be talking about the same toxin, which suggested to my criminal investigator mind, wow, we never identified who gave these children the candy, the orange. We never identified the toxin. We might have the same killer here. And of course, that led to the suspicion of a serial killer. Mm-hmm. loose in San Bernardino in 1915. Now, what's interesting is not only was Cora Stanton labeled a suicide, but the first death was a man who allegedly committed suicide. And the final victim was a man who, we are told, committed suicide, each with guns. And the one victim out of all these seven mystery deaths who wasn't accused of being a suicide, he wasn't poisoned, he drowned in a lake in the mountains here, in a rafting accident, a boating accident. And that one, I'll be honest, my co-author and I in the first book, Richard B. Spence, we thought, well, you know, the most thinly connected death of all these seven, if we're trying to connect them, is Isidore Jaussaud, the guy who died in the mountains. Well, you know, a couple of years ago, however, I found what I'm convinced is the smoking gun that definitely connects him to the other six deaths. And that is in theme, because the overarching strangest thing about all these seven deaths and this whole Empire of the Wheel thing in the original investigation, the original discovery, is that each death reflects esoterica. Each death reflects occult symbology that connects all these deaths to the goddess Hecate, for one.
Hmm.
And when I started looking at the players in town in 1915, just those that were present and those who were directly involved in the Cora Stanton mystery, it got even more interesting in a big way. So like the book, you know, a lot of people, I like to joke, you know, when they start to read the trilogy, I say, well, if you get through the first book, you'll really, really enjoy the second and third, because I'll admit, the first book, I had the co-author, I had Rick on the first book, and, we agreed that this mystery is just so confounding and so big in its own way that it's really hard to streamline, you know, that book. So it's a lot thrown at you, because, to be honest, when we jumped into this mystery, it was a lot thrown at me. It was a lot thrown, you know, at both of us.
Right. And you just kept finding more and more connections.
Yeah. It was just the nature of this Empire of the Wheel beast, is very complex.
Now, why is it called the Empire of the Wheel?
Well, because it takes place in San Bernardino, which at the time was the heart of the Inland Empire. And the wheel is the symbol of Hecate.
Okay.
The legendary goddess of witches. I will tell you that when I started this research, I too saw Hecate as this dark, foreboding, often evil, dark goddess of the underworld. And as I went through this, I can't call it anything but an adventure, because it has been one hell of a, it's been a personal journey, this investigation and writing these three books. But my perceptions of Hecate herself have changed tremendously as I've learned more about her, and I've learned, the bigger picture on what all was involved with this mystery. But that's where Empire of the Wheel comes from, the Inland Empire and the wheel. And I suspect, as we go into in the book, that there was a group that was doing some very dark things in veneration of the darker aspects of Hecate.
Hmm.
Therefore, Empire of the Wheel.
Okay. All right. Now, this also, is it these series of books that also connect into the whole airship mystery?
Oh, boy. Yes. Yes, indeed they do. And that was a surprise that just, it was nagging me. And what became the second book, what emerged as the second book, forced me to look closer at that little tidbit from the first book that was nagging me. And that just kind of opened a floodgate. Actually, the second book, Empire of the Wheel 2, Friends from Sonora, that was not intended to be, that's not what Empire of the Wheel 2 I intended to be. Actually, when you read Empire of the Wheel 3, The Nameless Ones, that would have been the second book. But what happened was, in the first book, while all these weird deaths are happening, a young man, 24 years old, is arrested on a train bound for Barstow. It's still here in the station in San Bernardino, but it's bound for Barstow. And there's a young man named Frank Rosasco who is essentially losing his mind. He's sitting there on the train. He's hallucinating the face of a woman. And he's just gibbering and muttering about being persecuted over something that happened to a woman, something he didn't do. And he's clutching a woman's purse that has some cash in it. And this is the state he's in when law enforcement is called and they come and they arrest him. They remove him from the train. They take him to county hospital where he is diagnosed as dangerously paranoid. So here you have a woman who died under very mysterious circumstances, found floating in the lake in the park. Here you have two children that, by this point, that have already been poisoned with candy, and they don't know who gave the children the poison. They can't identify the poison. Now remember, the 14-year-old girl at this time has not been killed. But still, you have these deaths of these two children and this woman. And here's this guy losing it on the train, clutching a woman's purse. And I believe at the time still, the paper had even talked about how when they did a search where they found the woman's body, they found no lady's purse. So you can do the math there. Was this her purse? Was this the guy that poisoned these children? And we've got him here at the county hospital. He is diagnosed as dangerously paranoid. Do we have the serial killer here? You know, this had to have been going through the mind of law enforcement. Well, what the papers tell us is that young Frank Rosasco is released into the custody of unidentified friends from Sonora. And he's let go. Now, that nagged at me because I was already vaguely familiar with the Sonora Aero Club and the strange, you know, the mysterious NIMSA and the weird stuff. I hadn't delved as deep into it as I would as a result of this. So it was in the back of my mind. I thought, okay, wow, could that be Sonora, California, you know, or is it Sonora, Mexico, or Sonora, I think, in Texas or whatever. And it was just nagging me. And then I had my research materials out, and I was trying to dig into a little bit more as to who Cora Stanton could be, because in the first book, Rick and I conclude that we did not for a minute believe that Cora Stanton was this dead woman's real name. So we still kind of laid it out there that we felt like she was a mystery. That this Cora Stanton name, the alleged suicide letter, which, by the way, when I went to request to look at it at the police department here, it's, that's among some things that got destroyed. Okay. So, you know, we laid it out there. We posed the possibility that Cora Stanton was a mystery woman. So when I started digging around into who Cora Stanton might have been, I stumbled upon a woman whose name I was very familiar with. And it had never occurred to me because I'd never seen this info before. But, you know, she turned up on a famous missing persons list. And I thought, wow, okay, I didn't realize she's considered missing, because in her chapter of history, you hear about where she was last known to be. But the focus are her two associates, not her. So, you know, I'd never really thought, well, whatever happened to her? And it was one of those times, like I said, with Alfred Watkins, it was like ice down my shirt. I got the goosebumps and I thought, oh my God, no, it couldn't be. And so I compared physical descriptions and I accounted for the last time the famous woman was seen was, I want to say 6 years prior, you know, or so. And I counted for, well, okay, the woman in 1915 identified as Cora Stanton, you know, her weight's a little heavier, such and such, but the height is the same. Wow, could it be? And the more I dug, the more I came to the conclusion that that I still hold today, that I think I know who Cora Stanton actually was. And what that led to was looking deeper at what was going on in 1915, and of course it was World War I, and going back to the first book and realizing, okay, because of the railroad there, because of the German guns being smuggled through the American Southwest to San Diego, that would have had to have transited through San Bernardino. So you've got German agents, right, that most definitely would have been active in San Bernardino here, making sure those gun shipments coming from the Southwest are then properly transported to San Diego, because San Bernardino was the railroad hub, okay, for passengers and freight at that time. If it was going through Southern California, it came through San Bernardino. So I'm thinking German agents, and then we got this Frank Rosasco guy, and the Sonora Aero Club, and the source of that's a German immigrant. And I'm thinking, wow, Germans, and we have this woman whose own legend is associated very famously with South America, and oops, there's a German synchronicity connection there for you. And it was just this swirl of, wow, what could the airship Germans have had to do with this mystery? Was indeed Frank Rosasco, connected to Sonora, California, of the Sonora Aero Club? And yes, I found that he indeed was, that the Rosasco family is a very respectable ranching family, Italian ranching family, that has been in the Tuolumne County area since the days of the Sonora Aero Club. And we also know from Charles Delshow that it was Italian rancher families that were giving the Sonora Aero Club use of their hangars, or use of their barns on their farms to use as hangars, essentially, for these flying machines. And I thought, oh my gosh, okay, what have I really stumbled upon here? You know, what the heck is going on? So that's how Empire of the Wheel 2, Friends from Sonora, happened. There's a little bit more detail to it, of course, you know, that's in the book, but, I wasn't expecting.
Right. So it just kind of all fell into place.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know if it'll ruin it for the readers. I mean, I've talked about it elsewhere. You can probably Google it online, but I could say who I think Cora Stanton actually
is. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, I'm convinced that the mysterious Cora Stanton of this 1915 mystery in San Bernardino was actually Etta Place. Okay. Etta Place, the alleged girlfriend or wife of Harry Longabaugh, the Sundance Kid. Etta Place, associate of Butch and Sundance. And when I first came out with this and first posed it, people were like, what the heck? But when they look at the details that I present, it becomes a little less what the heck.
Now, how does this feed into the actual airship mystery of the turn of the century?
Well, what you have, and I lay this out, I think, for the first time in greater detail in my book Origin, the 19th century emergence of the 20th century breakaway civilizations. where I show the thread that ties the Aero Club, the Sonora Aero Club of the 1850s, which Del Shall tells us about. I show the threads that probably tie that to the 1890s airship mystery. NIMSA, of course, the mysterious NIMSA organization being one of those threads. Del Shall is our original source on NIMSA, but of course,
tell us where NIMSA comes from.
NIMSA is the name of the organization first mentioned by Charles Del Shall, himself a German immigrant. He claims that NIMSA sent him in the 1850s out here to California to observe the progress of the Sonora Aero Club and their progress in building flying machines. Okay? Yes, in the 1850s. Now, NIMSA, according to Del Shall, was a German organization headquartered in Germany. Now, at that time, there was not a unified Germany, so you're talking more technically a Prussian organization. And what we get from Del Shall is that it was this group of Germans who could provide the resources to pursue powered flight. And so NIMSA was kind of a sponsor of these little groups here in the States that were attempting to use a very arcane, mysterious knowledge to build flying machines, which essentially, for lack of a better description, use some type of anti-gravity. Now, in the 1850s, according to Del Shall's drawings of these things, we're talking about, you know, something that's more like a contraption. I do a chart in my Origins book where I show the progression of, you know, these arrows to the airship to the modern flying saucer, kind of like the progress of the automobile. The Del Shall arrow of the 1850s, you know, done by the Sonora Aero Club, that's like the Model T, the Ford Model T, okay? Just basic proof of concept car, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. Then when you get to the 1890s, they become a little bit more complex, okay? A little bit bigger. That's kind of equivalent to what the 1958 Buick, say, would be to the Ford Model T, right?
Okay.
And so then the next progression, you know, you get into the 20th century here, and by the time we get to the classic, say, silver S4 classic flying saucer model, that'd be equivalent to, you know, a 1985 Porsche. So you follow the, you know, what we're talking about here. The stuff they were fooling around with in the 1850s also happens to resonate with the descriptions of the technology, some of the technology you see with these airships in the 1890s. And some writers have pointed out a NIMSA association to some of the players in the 1890s mystery. So using this data, I threaded from the 1850s German-based NIMSA, according to Del Shall and the guys here in California, I try to argue that the 1890s airship mystery is the progression of that technology. And then, of course, by the time we get into the 20th century and, the World War II in the 1950s, it would be the next progression. That's how I've kind of threaded it together.
Now, who is Del Shall?
Del Shall?
Yeah.
Charles Del Shall was a German immigrant who came to the U.S. Through Texas. And he claims he came here under instructions by NIMSA to go observe the Sonora Aero Club here in California. Okay. And he spent some time, a few years here with them. He befriended them. None of them were fond of the NIMSA itself. Del Shall talks about when Germany sent, you know, one of the direct NIMSA representatives to request that these guys start building these things with a military application. Dale Schell talks about how nobody liked this guy. They described him as that Prussian officer, and none of these guys wanted to build these things for the military. They were opposed to that back then. Now, this is Dale Schell writing this in these amazing diaries and art books that he wrote starting in the 1890s, I believe, up until 1923 when he died. And they were found basically in a heap of what was going to be trash in a junk shop by a guy named Pete Navarro in 1971. We never would have learned about Dale Schell or the mysterious NIMSA really from his perspective had Navarro not seen these things and become fascinated with them. What's also interesting is several of these books ended up in the possession of the DeMenil family, who, if you look at, you know, your circle of JFK assassination lore and mythology, the I'm not pronouncing their name right, the DeMenils or DeMenils, they're in there. And you know, they ended up in possession of several of these books. Now, when you think about, you know, the potential post-World War II Nazi link to the JFK assassination, and you think about the German connection with NIMS and such, it makes the DeMenils having these books, you know, all the more a curious thing.
Now, aren't there people who think these books are just fantasy?
Oh, of course. Yeah, there's people out there that will just tell you, oh, he's nothing but an outsider artist. They just want to see Dale Schell. It's all a flight of fantasy. They want to just equate him with Darger and you know, other people that the art doesn't really mean anything that happened. And he was just that. He was just an outsider artist. Nothing to see here, people. You know, it's all about the art. Of course, yeah.
So what makes you sure it's not?
Well, the technology that these guys were fooling around with is curiously resonant with what we hear about Mercury Vortex engines, allegedly used in, of course, ancient India, you know, in other applications, you know, separate from what we hear in Dale Schell, and then how some of the similar things turned up in the 1890s mystery. And the fact, when you look at the German connection, it just makes Dale Schell resonate with too much actual texture to be written off as an outsider artist. It makes you wonder who's behind pushing, you know, this story that he's just an outsider artist. I mean, that could be NIMSA representatives, right? You know, sure. Ignore that man behind the curtain.
Are they still around today?
I think so.
Okay.
You mean NIMSA, right?
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I think so. I think basically NIMSA became what, you know, Joseph Farrell calls the Nazi International, what we all call, you know, the hand behind the military industrial complex. I'm in the middle of doing a vid series, just kind of putting out the basics of my research on that. I do think that this this organization that began as a Prussian group driving German unification in the 19th century, as they progressed and they achieved that, they were the driving force behind the foundation and the rise of the Nazi Party. And of course, they, you know, as they got what they wanted out of that whole experience and the horror that the Nazis caused, they continued on. And in my opinion, kind of quietly conquered the U.S., you might say, you know, post-World War II, using Operation Paperclip as their Trojan horse.
And it seems I had on, I'm blanking on his name, the Greys Have Been Framed. Completely blanking on his name right now, but he was talking about the Operation Paperclip. and pointing out that a lot of people who were involved in some of these programs experimenting on Americans, you know, like MK Ultra and stuff, actually were a result of a Operation Paperclip.
Oh yeah, yeah. MK Ultra came out of what some of the German scientists that we, and I'm using air quotes here, you know, captured, brought from their psychiatric research and such. Yeah, absolutely. MK Ultra, you know, we did that based on what we learned from those guys, and all sorts of bad things have ensued since then.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure. You know, that's just MK Ultra is one of the only ones we know about and have, like, you know, documentation for. And most of that was destroyed, too.
Well, what's interesting is, and I talk about this in my book, Shimmering Light, is that, and I didn't know this until I was doing the research on the book. In the 1950s, while the CIA was really notching up and developing the MK Ultra technology, so to speak, the military branches were keenly interested in it, and the most enthusiastic military customer of CIA MK Ultra technology was the United States Air Force. They were so enamored with it that they started their own independent MK Ultra program. Okay? Independent. Now, when you look at the Church Committee in 1973, where the CIA had to sit before Congress and come clean on MK Ultra, well, the CIA had to do that, but the U.S. Air Force did not. To this day, we do not know how far the Air Force took their MK Ultra program. Think about that.
Yeah, that's a little disturbing. And most of the MK Ultra documents were destroyed anyway.
Many of them, yeah.
Because as soon as they knew they were going to be looked at, they started destroying documents.
Yeah, yeah, the, you know, the smoking gun stuff, of course. But that's the CIA.
Yeah,
the Air Force, they weren't hauled before Congress. They probably didn't have to destroy anything.
Now, how does this stuff make you feel, having worked in the government? Like,
oh, I'm an Air Force officer.
Okay, so how does that, you know, how does your take on that go?
Well, and you know. I do go into this in greater detail in the book, but I'm going to tell you, I'm not one of those that says, oh, you got to read the book. My view of the Air Force embracing MK Ultra in the 50s, you got to remember we were deep in this Cold War thing. Everybody was paranoid about the bomb this and the Russians missiles that and such that I really think that the Air Force would have applied MK Ultra in most cases as a means to protect operational security on various programs and such. In other words, they used this potentially nefarious tool, but they meant well, sincerely meant well. You know, like, hey guys, and I talk about it within the context of my dad's experience because I'm convinced that my dad essentially underwent MK Ultra stuff. And I think in those days what it was, hey guys, come in here. Not only do we have you sign a non-disclosure agreement, not only do we know you're patriotic guys and you don't want to share any secrets or spill any, well, we got this great new toy. What we can do is have our psychiatrist come in here and we're going to hypnotically repress all the stuff we don't want you to talk about when you leave the operation. And, you know, I know how it is to be in the military. I'm sure the personnel were like, all right, you know, straighten up and fly right. Let's me first, you know, because it was probably presented as this is going to help us all. This is going to help you, right? Unfortunately, the serious downside is, you know, how many people's minds were messed up with this stuff.
Yeah.
And I think my dad, you know, was messed with, you know, over the years, you know, as well, because of this. So, you know, that's honestly, I think they went into using this thinking it was this great new thing. I would hope, and knowing the Air Force just to the extent that I do, I was only on active duty for 6 years. I'm a reserve officer. Inactive reserve. They, you know, can call me back at any time. I would hope that, you know, over the years and when they saw what happened with CIA and what CIA had to admit to, I would hope, and knowing the Air Force, I think they probably kind of put the brakes on a lot of whatever they might have been doing and, you know, kind of learn what to apply and what not to use anymore. And just figured, well, we dodged the congressional committee bullet. Let's just, again, straighten up and fly right. That is one thing I would say based on my experience with the Air Force and how they are, but hey, let's be realistic. We don't know. I mean, you know, one of the biggest Air Force jerks in, you know, of recent years, you know, that we've encountered is Michael Hayden. You know, he's a big Air Force general guy. So, you know, if there's one like him, there unfortunately might be more that, you know, who knows, maybe they've done nefarious things. But I don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. I don't, you know, I don't condemn the entire Air Force for whatever, you know, bad eggs might be in it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's fair enough. So if NIMSA's still around, is this what we're looking at as a breakaway civilization?
Yes. I do think that what was NIMSA, whatever they call themselves now, is the my personal view theory is that there are two breakaway civilizations, and this NIMSA, this German one, is one of them. And in my opinion, my analysis, it is the one that we would call, you know, the New World Order or the globalists. Today we would call them the globalists. They're the ones who are driving globalism. They are the ones who drive collectivism. They are the ones driving transhumanism, anything that just wants to assimilate you into their Borg. yes. And they're the ones who are really what I consider, and many of my colleagues and other people I know consider to be, you know, the bad players, the totalitarians. And you have the other group, in my opinion, that I think they have been kind of out of involvement. They've been kind of away developing themselves, because I don't think they actually broke away until the early years of the 20th century. So all those years that the German group, NIMSA, had been developing itself as an organization through the 19th century, these guys, this other group, they were really just kicking off in the early 20th century, which I think explains greatly their, you know, apparent, very apparent absence, you know, during the World War eras. But I think that they have recently kind of come back to the chessboard and are, you know, shaking some things up. Now, are they, you know, necessarily the good guys, so to speak? You know, it might be too soon to tell. I do think that they are in direct opposition to NIMSA. I think these two groups are definitely rivals, and I do not think this other group are globalist totalitarians. So it, in my opinion, it's going to get interesting. it's going to get real interesting.
But this stuff is pretty much hidden from us.
Yes and no, you know, I mean, think about it. We already see, you know, this military industrial complex thing we've known about for decades. You know, people have been screaming about these globalists and weird stuff going on, you know, for decades, easily, you know, since World War II. So yeah, they kind of are, but hidden from us, but not exactly, you know. You could see their bloody hand in the, you know, the background of the JFK assassination.
Sure.
9/11 has some big questions about it, where I think, again, you see NIMSA's hand in there. Mm-hmm. So they are hidden, but then again, they're not really. When you look back, I think, you know, if they ever emerge or the, you know, they're exposed, I think when you look back on it, we'll realize how how much they were not hidden, how much more out there they actually were.
Okay. It feels like we're looking at it through inference at this point.
Yeah. Yeah, but inference that is when you as an individual really look closely at the details, you begin to see that there is a fabric there, and you begin to see the texture, and you begin to see that the inference has a little bit more to it than just a leap, you know.
Okay.
To somebody who hasn't, you know, looked closely at it, I readily, you know, admit that, yeah, that's what it looks like from, you know, from outside or from afar. I say that because I have had people that initially they were very skeptical, and then when they read the books and when they talked with me about it, they changed their mind. They said, "Oh, you know what? There's something to this." And I admit that, you know, I might be a bit off in exactly what it is, you know, but I think I think I'm basically on the right path here with this.
Okay. Fair enough. I think part of the problem too is there's so much conspiracy culture out there.
Yes.
That when you throw anything out there, there are some people that just immediately say, "Oh, another conspiracy theory."
Right.
And I don't know if that's not totally by design at this point.
It might be. That's just it. I you know, throw so much at people and they won't know what to hang on to. And at some point they'll just give up. They'll just not want to hear it. And there you go.
Yeah. And that solves their problem of the stuff getting out.
Yeah. So that even when, you know, some knucklehead like me comes along and I have some degree of, you know, having it right in my books, it won't be noticed because of all the noise, you know? Yeah. And, I took a while back after the first book, I took, the position of, hey, you know, decide for yourself. In fact, I drive some people mad. I drive people with, what our friend Greg calls the certainty fetish. I drive those people with that fetish nuts because I just will not tell them what to think or what to conclude. I tell people what I think about this stuff. But I leave it for the reader to decide. If you read, you know, any of my books, but if you read these Empire of the Will books and you come away going, "Oh, Bosley's a knucklehead. He doesn't know what he's talking about. This is garbage." Okay. That's fine. Because, you know, someone else will read it and have, you know, a different opinion.
Well, sure. And unless you can present absolute, you know, undeniable proof.
Yeah.
And I think that's the problem with a lot of conspiracies is a lot of conspiracies are people throwing together connections.
Yes.
You know, and just playing connect the dots without any evidence to back it up.
Yeah, without any evidence to back it up. You know, what I try to do is, in spite of what I get accused of by some naysayers, you know, I present these facts that, you know, I'm not making this stuff up. They're in these old newspapers. You can find them. I cite them, you know, I provide my sources and such. And I do my analysis. You know, here's what I think. You got these people within the context of all this stuff that actually happened is going on, and you got all the facts and data that these individuals bring with them. Well, it's, you know, what's going on here? Well, here's what I think is going on here. And, you know, I present that. And sometimes folks, when they don't want to accept your premise, when they don't want to accept your speculation or conclusion, again, we come back to throwing the baby out with the bathwater. They just want to trash everything. They even want to say that the facts and the actual historical real things that you presented, they even want to say that, well, that's garbage, that's made up. You know, they don't want to say, well, I disagree with this guy's conclusion, but golly, I don't know what to say about the other stuff because he's presented this really happened, that really happened, this context was really here. No, they just want to, what they want to do is see that you are rejected wholesale. You know, it's, I don't buy this one part, so I don't think anybody should buy any of it. And, I find that reaction to be suspicious, you know, sometimes.
Yeah. Well, that's sort of the, I'm sure I'm right. And what I believe already is what's true and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
You know, they don't have room for new things.
Right. Or an opposing, you know, and then there's people who just flat out don't like speculation. I have a good time with my bad reviews. I will post them and I will make fun of them.
Nice.
And one of my favorites is when one of these guys will complain about, oh, this guy speculates. And then I'll point out, yeah, I identify that I'm speculating. I think in one book it was 37 times. I say, I'm speculating here. And yet his complaint is as if I'm not admitting that it's speculation. So I have fun with boneheaded reviews like that, where they're masters of the obvious. Of course, Walter Bosley speculates. I'm very upfront about that. That's, you know, to me, that's always been part of the fun of reading the kind of stuff that I write.
Right.
The speculations, you know.
And as long as you identify it as such, then that's a great thing.
Exactly. And I do sufficiently through my books. So yeah, that's why I have fun with those kind of reviews, because, you know, you get the people who clearly haven't really read the book and such. And what are we to think about, you know, that? But, going back to the original thing, the Empire of the Wheel thing is just this big, fat, decade-spanning, weird thing, you know, that starts in 1915, and it's not all fun and games, because in the first book, you know, we expressed a concern that the number 100 is two numbers are most associated with Hecate: the number 3, she's a triple aspect goddess, and the number 100. And Hecate is sometimes venerated in with the number 100 in terms of 250s and such. Anyway, in the first Empire of the Wheel book, published in 2011, Rick and I suggest, you know, a concern that, you know, will somebody do something in 2015 in veneration of Hecate as an homage to what happened here in San Bernardino? You know, will at the time I was concerned about it being a traditional serial murderer. I was concerned one would emerge in 2015. And I thought on the morning of December 2nd, 2015, that, well, it looks like we're going to get through this year and that's not going to happen. That's good when a dark prediction, a dark concern doesn't come true. And yeah. I was probably thinking, speaking a little too soon, because as we know, that's when the San Bernardino shooters attacked and killed 14 people. Now, the 2nd of December 2015 was the 100th anniversary of one of the 7 victims in 1915. Okay, 100 being a number associated with Hecate, so you got the 100th anniversary of this girl's death. Oh, and by the way, she was 14 years old. And you had 14 victims. So I did a little video laying out all the synchronicities between the death of Orta Hedges on December 2nd, 1915, and the San Bernardino shooting on December 2nd, 2015. And, that's just an example of the weirdness that one encounters when you jump into this Empire of the Wheel thing. My co-author, he told me, and he said it subsequently in an interview, that he never put much stock or much interest in the phenomena of synchronicity until he started working on this book with me, and after we worked on it, and then he began to notice it popping up everywhere.
Really?
Yeah, it made the experience of working on this book made him a believer that there's something significant about the experience of synchronicity. And he said it also, you know, hit home in a personal way during that time as well. Hmm. And so I got his attention, you know, by introducing him to all this stuff. What happened was, how we came together was, of course, Aleister Crowley is in the mix here in 1915. And so I read Secret Agent 666, which Rick Spence is the author of. Mm. And I contacted him to ask him a bunch of questions about Crowley. And the questions I was asking and what I told him I was researching, he was really interested in. He kept sending me great stuff, just loads of it. So finally I said, hey, would you be interested in working on this book with me? And he said, sure. And so that's how that happened. And yeah.
All right. And I hope you enjoyed that. Part two will be next week. Like I said, unless you're a Patreon, in which case you'll get the whole thing, plus an extra segment with Walter. All right. To take you out tonight, we're going to hear some Craft of Unknown Origin. I really like this band. This is some new stuff. This is a song called Dimension B248. See you next time.